Hi, and welcome to our Doc Industry Podcast, season number 6. Here's your podcast about creative documentary and animated film industry. It's in collaboration with our dear friends, the programmers of Color Collective, What's Up With Dogs, and Talking Shorts. Big shout out to our partners, supporters, and contributors. Please check them out. And hey, good to have you here again. Enjoy the conversation. Here is your Doc Industry Podcast, season number 6.
Okay, well, I just want to start by welcoming Rennell to the podcast. She is on the other side of the mic. And also just want to thank Ann and Nadia for inviting What's Up with Docs to participate this year with the Doc Lives podcast. So Rennell, welcome.
Thanks, Tony. Yeah, it's really good to actually be in conversation with you instead of listening in on conversation with you.
Exactly. So let's just start off with some visual descriptions. So I am a brown-skinned Black woman with sister locks and a ponytail, and I'm wearing a Black t-shirt, and I believe I have a white background.
So I am a white woman in my early 40s. I like to think I can still pass for early 30s, maybe not. I have medium length brown hair, blunt bangs right now. I'm wearing a Black dress with some flowers on it, and some movie posters and some records in my background. And you might hear a little bit of clip clomp of Zeta, one of my partner's dog, in the background.
Yeah, Onyx, my Black cat, may make an appearance. So, you know, she likes to participate in these things. All right. So I just want to start off by, I always like to start off this conversation by talking about like how we met. So we met when I was hired at the IDA. And originally I was part-time filmmaker services associate, whatever it was, and I got promoted to filmmaker services manager. So that's where we met, at the International Documentary Association.
I can't even remember what my role was at the time. You know, I had so many different jobs at the old IDA. So, but yeah, absolutely. Spent a lot of late nights. I actually think it was a late night when you came over and said hello to me. But immediately, you know, we started talking about RuPaul, and that was, it was on from there. That's for sure.
Yeah, we've attended many a drag cons together. So
yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, I think, you know, RuPaul is why I moved to L.A., you know. It was a real RuPaul gave me a kick in the butt in terms of like, you need to get on your career and you need to like get it together. And so, you know, it was a real influence as to why I moved to Los Angeles.
Well, okay, so talk more about that. So do you mean you were watching that first or second season of Drag Race?
First season. The interesting lighting they had going on in the first season. Everyone's very shiny. I was, you know, had just graduated from film school, studying documentary, and was trying to work on some films on my own, and, you know, in a very rural area without a lot of support system or a community around me. And then, what was this show? Started watching this show and just, I can't explain it. It was just kind of, you know, just seeing people just work so hard on building their identity and building this, like, this just fabulousness around them. It was just like, oh, I got to get to work. Like, I got to get to work. And also, I need more community around me. And so, you know, I had a friend who was living in L.A. She was working at Netflix. And she said, come sleep on my couch. And I did. And then, you know, a month later, I was working at IDA. So, yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize that. And so what year did you move to L.A.?
Oh, gosh, I can't even remember. It's been about 12 years now. So if you can do the math, I'm not good at the math, but it's been a long time. And yeah, it was just finally this year that I really officially finally left IDA for the last time. Yeah, we can talk a little bit about that. But But yeah, yeah, yeah. It's I say in a lot of ways that IDA did raise me because I did come in as an intern, basically, and sort of, you know, went up the ladder and worked all, like I said, so many different positions at that organization. But it really has helped to like come together and accumulate the work I'm doing now and the skills that, you know, helped me really build the skills to really get this organization off the ground.
Right, right. Yeah, so I think when we met, you were working, you're doing like half events and then half education.
Yeah, that's right. I was, you know, and I stayed in the education department for about 8 years. Eventually, you know, I started working on Getting Real in its first iterations in 2014. I had a little bit more of a influential role in 16. And then by 2018, I was the co-director of Getting Real and yeah, really got to put a lot of influence into what the programming and the directions and the communities that we supported with that particular iteration. I'm really proud of that work.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting Real would not have happened without Renell. You were doing everything. Yeah, you're amazing. You're amazing.
Just another spoke in the wheel, Tony. Just another spoke in the wheel.
I'm trying to give you some flowers, girl. Yeah, so like we definitely like bonded at the IDA, and I feel like working with you really gave me a taste of like what every working environment should be like, because with you it was always extremely collaborative.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, very collaborative, and you were always interested in, you know, hearing other people's ideas. And even if we didn't necessarily agree on something, that wasn't a place of conflict. It's just a place of negotiation.
Yeah.
You know? And then you're always so open to not only hearing feedback, particularly from like the filmmakers we serve, but also absolutely 1,000% incorporating that feedback to make things better for them. And like, you were the rare unicorn in that place. You kept me sane, I have to say. Amongst a lot of unfortunate turmoil and a work culture that was not really conducive to growth. Okay, so enough of that. So I actually kind of just want to talk about some of our relationships with the ways that we work together, particularly with how we came to work together on the podcast, What's Up with Docs, because that is story. And actually, that has some Doc Leipzig roots, too. So I think it was the first or second time I went to Doc Leipzig. Nadia and I were cast to work together to do a presentation at Montreal. And I happened to be in Germany at the time, and we were trying to coordinate a time to meet. And I knew she was in Germany, but I didn't realize she was in Berlin. And Nadia's like, oh, I'm in Berlin. And I was like, oh, I'm in Berlin. So Nadia and I met up to talk about this presentation that we're going to do at the Documentary Festival in Montreal. We were doing a presentation on funding for documentaries in the U.S. and Europe. So when we both arrived in Montreal, we did the presentation really well. There was a lot of great feedback from people who were in the audience. And Nadia and I actually went out for coffee like a couple of hours later, and we were having a conversation, and I was kind of like lamenting some of my experiences at IDA. And she asked me, well, what do you really like to do? And I said, you know, I really enjoy being in conversation with people like you and like talking about the field. And that night, that kind of like stayed on my mind. And then I woke up the next morning, it's like, ooh, podcast. And the podcast with people that I've met throughout the industry who don't necessarily get celebrated, because in the documentary industry, only certain people get platformed. And I was very tired of seeing that. And then it came to me, what's up with Docs? And then when I came back to the U.S., I told you about it. This is like in 2019. Before the world shifted, and you were like, okay, bet, let's do it. I went over to your house, and you had all this equipment, and apparently you had the secret life as a sound person.
I do.
Yes, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, no, I studied filmmaking at Columbia College in Chicago, but I actually when I started school, I thought I wanted to be an audio engineer. I thought I wanted to record albums. Yeah, I got into that deeper into that, and I said, "Oh, no, I don't. No, I don't." It was a very alienating space for women for sure. And I felt that. But, it was also, there wasn't a lot of agency, or at least I didn't feel like there was a lot of agency in that kind of media form. And so I was in a production class. I was in an audio production editing class, and I got to do a audio documentary about the transition of analog to digital, specifically for library systems. And, it was specifically around the Harold Washington Library there in Chicago. It's a big, beautiful library in Chicago. And then just fell in love, just fell in love with being able to edit, to be able to manipulate, to be able to have control, to be able to tell stories. It just felt so freeing in a way that I didn't even know that that was something that I could do. And then I've just kind of been a lover of, audio editing ever since, but kind of, keep it in the little background. I've got a lot of interests, and I do a lot of different things all the time. So, it was really great. I eventually got to teach at USC. I taught an audio podcasting course. And it was great because it was all students, there was no prerequisite. It was just students from all different majors. And it was really cool to like see particularly students who aren't necessarily initially creatives or saw themselves as creatives, like find themselves through that medium. And so, yeah, it's just one of the things, one of the aspects of myself that came out. But yeah, it was, I think, we started that podcast, just around the time, of George Floyd's murder. And, there were aspects of what was happening in a lot of legacy organizations that needed to be pushed back against, that needed to be changed, that needed to be talked about. And yeah, you were just the right person to come in with the right point of view at the time. And I really look back on that set of work that we did together on the podcast, and just really proud of it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, because we recorded our first episode at Big Sky Documentary Film Festival with Tracy Rector. We did two episodes there. And we were very excited because the plan was so we would go to fest because we were traveling to all these festivals together. Was like we would just bring our equipment and then we would record episodes like each
Right,
festival. And
right.
but then Miss Rona decided to change things up a bit, and we had to do this online format, which actually kind of the norm. But yeah, it was a really great time. And then also. Like, yeah, looking back, I think there was this zeitgeist happening in the industry, like this conversation around like decolonizing docs that have been just, that have been in the air for a long time. But in my opinion, there have been really no like I feel like no concrete movement on that as far as like changing the industry within because one thing I've noticed, like when I was fully in the documentary industry, is there is this need to almost talk about things, and the idea of talking about them is enough versus actually implementing the change.
Oh, yeah. Leadership's got to buy in. It's the biggest challenge that we see in the disability community as well, is, that commitment has to come from the top.
Yeah, and you have to do. You have to do. You have to do. So I do want to. I want to talk about the Getting Real convenings because I think like this is where I began to see you in action. But then also like the purpose of the Getting Real convenings that you developed was to actually build a platform for marginalized communities just to have a space to engage in any way they wanted. And then I had to work with you directly when we did the one for the Indigenous convening. But I want to talk about, for you to talk about some of the convenings that you have to develop, particularly the A1 for Asian Americans, and then the filmmakers with disabilities. But actually, let's skip that one, because we're going to get to that, because when we get into Disability and Media Alliance. But let's talk about the Asian Americans, and then just the planning. I want to talk about some of the logistics of planning something like that, because, you know, there's all this conversation about, which I've backed away from, around like creating a seat at the table. And I've come to realize, like, I don't want to be at some of these tables. In fact, I don't want to have these houses. Yeah. In fact, I live in Mexico now. So that's how much I want to be different. But what I feel like in the spirit of what you were doing with these various convenings was, you were helping people to create their own, you know, and giving people the space to be in dialogue with each other so they could decide like what they wanted and what they want to be.
Yeah, I like to say I didn't do much. It's the communities that did the work, but we just gave them space and gave them what they want. You know, a lot of times we overcomplicate what support has to look like, and we have to insert our ideas or insert ourselves into what, like, that has to, you know, what support looks like. And, you know, I like to keep it simple and just like listen to people, ask them what they want, and give it to them. And so a lot of that was just like, just recognizing, as you said, that people needed just to be together, just to like ideate, just to like dream and talk about what the different possibilities can be. And a big part of you know, the ADOC convening started in 2016. It was really started a lot by Grace Lee. And yeah, it's now since gone on and grown to be its own organization. But it was clear from the success of ADOC and what happened there that we needed to create that space for more communities. And so we continue to do that and continue to develop space as people are rising, as like institutions were organizing. Sometimes it just takes that ability and that moment to be able to come together for bigger things to come to come out of it. Another one was Forward Doc. Initially, it was in 2018, you know, and I had a lot of personal reasons why that was, you know, important for me. We can go into that. But, you know, we organized the first convening of disabled filmmakers in Los Angeles with the support from Jim Lebrecht, of course, who's the co-director of Crip Camp. And then Cassie Diamond, who's now the executive director. She helped support and get that convening together. And, you know, we also did a really amazing panel. And from that convening is what Forward Doc, you know, has now come to be, which is the largest organization and of disabled filmmakers in the world. And so, yeah, I'm really proud of that work. And, you know, it is, honestly, it is the beginnings of DMA as well. But it started there.
Yeah, so let's chat a little bit of like what it takes to do these convenings, because you said you don't do much, and that's a lie. You don't do much. That is a lie. No, because I'm speaking from the perspective, like working with you on the convening we did for the GOFA convening for Indigenous filmmakers, because there is a lot of purposeful work that you and I did in a lead up to having those conversations that actually made those convenings happen. So The first thing we did was, you know, the questionnaire.
Well, yeah, it also finding collaborators from the community itself, right, that really is already passionately engaged and involved and wants to connect larger, or wants to have a platform to connect with a larger group of people. You know, it's just like finding your collaborators is like really key. And we had such lovely people working with us on that. And like, but yeah, and I, you know, and yeah, like you said, that the questionnaire is like, What do people care about? What do people like? What is on the top of minds of people right now? And where are they not seeing the support that they need? Or what are the things that they're, ideating and dreaming about that would be, supportive to them? You have to engage with the communities. Like, you can't just come in and make decisions for people. I think that, again, my background as a caregiver has really influenced that for me. My mother was in a car accident when I was in my early 20s. She became quadriplegic from that accident. She did a job that was very similar to me, in that she would travel around and speak at conferences and speaking engagements all over. But she did it for the car industry. But it was after her accident, her job was no longer accessible. They made no attempts to make her job accessible. And so she stopped working, and it changed who she thought she was, the value of who she thought of what she contributed to the world. And it just had a real strong effect on me. And so, I, as the organize, as somebody who is starting to have a lot more influence in the institution at IDA, I just knew it was my responsibility to speak up and say, okay, we need to make this more accessible to all of our communities, and we need to make sure that, and also, and a kick in the butt from Jim Labrecht also helped. And it really. It does. You have to engage. You have to ask people what they want, and just not making decisions for people, and like really learning how to like listen, was really, something that it's only like in the past couple of years that I've actually recognized that for myself. Was like, oh yeah, that comes from my caregiving background to really make that sort of connection. But.
Right, it's like not being paternalistic, like really stepping away from that. Because when when I think back to the questionnaire, it was really involved, and we asked people essentially like overall, like when they were going into industries places, what worked for them, and we also asked them what didn't work for them, and then we actually. In addition to creating the questionnaire, we went into the community. So, like, you went to Imaginative and conducted, the survey there. And then we both went to Big Sky, met with a big group of Indigenous filmmakers there. And people at that festival were so helpful and like helping to like organize that. They're really engaged in that. But then also, we were very deliberate in incorporating that feedback they got. So one of the questions we asked is if you want this convening open or closed. You've asked it all the groups. So the Asian American filmmakers opted for a closed convening. And I remember that distinctly because it was at the firehouse, like right around the corner from the academy, and there was no AC on the bottom, and I had to check people in, and I have a heavy sweater. So yeah,
I apologize.
dehydration memories, but then the filmmakers with disabilities, they all wanted to have an open conversation.
It's, it just depended on like, who they were trying to reach and who they were trying to speak to. I think in that moment, the disabled community really wanted funders to hear the struggles they were going through. And so they wanted to make sure that they were in that space so they could hear. Because I think a lot at the time, there hadn't been a lot of opportunity for the disabled community to really, it really took the release of Crip Camp for the industry generally to take disabled makers seriously, because then they saw, oh, well, nominated for an Oscar and it's got a Netflix release and da da da. And oh, there's this whole community of stories that haven't been told. And so, yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, and then the Indigenous convening, they opted for a closed convening. And I actually want to get back to something you said with Crip Camp, but I did want to say this, that I think, even though, Miss Rona changed plans and we ended up having to do the Indigenous convening online, I actually think it might have been better. We had such more of a worldwide reach. I think we probably like reached more filmmakers. And then we actually, I remember we did two sessions. to accommodate different time zones. And then also, it was in multiple languages, so Spanish and English. And then some of our facilitators, like Grace Lee, translated the materials into the registration materials into Spanish for us. So, you know, it was a really...
Amalia.
Yes, Amalia. Yes, saying Amalia Cordova. Yes. Say her name, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And David Hernandez, too, little help as well with that.
For sure.
They single-handedly, particularly David, was instrumental in so much of the outreach and the participation we got from indigenous folks in South and Central America, because they were so tied into that.
Yeah.
So I do want to get back to Crip Camp quickly on the question of visibility, because I remember during when the pandemic happened and then all these festivals were doing their filmmaker and their decision-making meetings online. I think between March and November, when I was asked to leave the IDA, that I maybe did maybe like 200 plus filmmaker meetings. It was a lot because, you know, I like to engage with filmmakers, even though that was a lot. But one thing I distinctly remember was there seemed to be all of a sudden, and I know it's not all of a sudden, this whole influx of filmmakers of various disabilities so I was meeting with. And then when I would step back to think about, okay, where were all these people? Well, they've always been there. It's just been, number one, a lot of these festivals aren't accessible.
Yep.
Plus, you know, when we go to these events, it's always on the go. And it's very hyper-stimulating, probably for a lot of people who are potentially neurodivergent, because I actually found myself in conversations with neurodivergent filmmakers, and they felt like this online forum was like beneficial for them because, you know, they could participate when they wanted to, but if they needed to step away, they could, you know? And I was really hoping that once the pandemic technically didn't end, but once like things quote unquote got back to normal, as far as like normal outdoor day-to-day activities, that we would actually, some of these festivals would keep like a hybrid model. So these films normally, for whatever reasons, don't travel to festivals. Oh, another issue with travel is people with accessibility equipment, it might get damaged. Yeah.
It's a huge problem.
That's another reason why a lot of filmmakers may not, with disabilities, are very cautious about when they travel. So I was hoping that some of these festivals would keep some aspects of that hybridity in order to make these spaces more accessible to all these amazing filmmakers. But I don't know if they've held on to some of those things, because yes, COVID was very hard, but also I think it opened our eyes into like different ways we could work and be in the world.
And live, just different ways of living. I mean, it really dramatically changed at the time, especially for nonprofits, the life-work dynamic, right? Which many nonprofits have been unhealthy environments. People are overworked, underpaid, and not even sometimes even given, you know, the respect that they deserve for the hard work that they do. And so, yeah, Corona was definitely awful, but it also taught us that we can live and work differently, and it's possible, and it's easy, and it's not hard. But I agree with you. We're seeing more and more, especially institutions asking their folks to come back to the office and working full weeks in office and these kinds of scenarios. And it really does. And, I don't know if people really understand how much that really truly does impact the disabled community and the opportunities that are, you know, made available to them, whether that's as makers or just, you know, having a job just in general. I think, you know, clearly a lot of this is driven by capitalism and the new dynamic, especially here in the U.S. With our new administration. But yeah, I hold on to those values. And, it's a very hybrid environment at DMA still, and will continue to be. And so, but yeah, I I really encourage, institutions to really think about that and to think who that you're leaving out when you, bring those kind of structures back into your institutions.
Exactly. Yeah. So I want to get back to the brief time you left the IDA. You began to work with 1 in 4.
Yeah. That was a real life changer working with that group of folks. After I left IDA for a little while and, my good friend Jim Lebrecht reached out to me and said that, he had, in addition to Forward Doc, he was also starting another new organization with, I think it was 8 other disabled industry individuals that was more focused on the Hollywood system, but they were, they needed someone. They were all sort of, industry figures, whether, Erin Brown, who is a manager for writers, and Caitlin Yang, she is a visual effects artist and a supervisor. She runs her own visual effects company. Everyone, all the founders of part of that organization are all, really established folks in the industry, and they just wanted to use their influence to bring more disabled folks and get more disabled folks jobs in the industry. And, like I said, everyone, it was a different dynamic for me because everyone on that team identified as disabled at the time and I didn't. But, it was, I learned so much. And as I was going through it, I started to like really recognize that, oh, girl, you're neurodivergent. you have mental health conditions and like that is part of the community. And it's time for you to come out. It's time for you to start talking about these things and these parts of your identity and recognize that they are what makes you unique and what has helped you maneuver through this industry the way that I have. And so, I now proudly identify as disabled. And it really took being in an environment where that was okay and that everyone was welcoming. And it was a real change for me. But it was also working in that environment, that I saw how this really great, I always say that they cured me of my cynicism of the nonprofit industry because I was working with some really passionate, dedicated people that truly believed in the work they were doing. And I really appreciate them and sing their praises constantly because they brought me back. They brought me back to this work.
Love that. Well, I don't think you ever, they brought you back to the nonprofit piece?
I was I was gone. After that first time of IDA, I was so burnt. I was so burnt out and so,
totally.
So affected by my experience and just felt like, I just didn't feel like that everybody was in it in the same way that I was in it. And it just felt really alienating and just I felt alone. But mostly hurt. Yeah. Just being in that environment was just like, oh, right. There are all these like really authentic people that truly believe what they're doing and aren't going to compromise their values to get there.
Yeah. I mean, I always say post-traumatic nonprofit syndrome is a thing. Totally. And like for me, when I was at the IDA, I was also working with Ani Mercedes and Looky Pictures. And like working with you was amazing. Right. Mm-hmm. But everybody else. But I particularly in 2020, I just began to notice a contrast, like how it feel, when I would do my work with Looky Looky and how open it was and how collaborative and the care that it went into it.
Yeah.
And then the contrast at the IDA where there was like a lot of urgency, but it wasn't like purposeful, you know, but a lot, but also a lot of performative stuff as well. That contrast, particularly just the isolation that was the year 2020, like really it made things very distinct, you know. You can feel the difference. You can feel the difference. Yeah. So how long did you work for 1 and 4?
Oh, I was at 1 and 4 for like 2 years. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was for a while. And yeah, it was, you know, it was being at 1 and 4 that brought me back to IDA. We were asked to, so IDA received quite a bit of money from the Ford Foundation. They did a grant application in partnership with Forward Doc to create a fund specifically for disabled makers. And they were creating an advisory committee to help, you know, formulate the idea around that. And they asked 1 and 4 to join. They, after a little bit, at the time, Keisha Knight was running that. And she asked me to come back. She's just like, you need to come back and just sort of finish this work out. And that's what I did. It was interesting too. They also, I think one of the things that really helped seal the deal for me to come back was also they invited me to participate in a panel at Getting Real and to talk about my experience and to talk about what institutions, how institutions are damaging to the people that work within them and to really be open and to like, speak my truth. And so, you know, that was a really big influence as to why I came back. And yeah. Yeah.
I think in a way, maybe it's like the organization making a little bit of amends.
Yeah. Yeah.
That conversation is online and you interviewed a group of amazing people, including Gemma Desai, who wrote, I think a piece of like a masterpiece called This Work Is Not For Us. Like everyone who has ever felt sidelined or marginalized in the industry needs to read that. It's actually a dissertation she wrote about her experiences and the experiences of other British folks of color in the documentary industry.
Yeah, the beautiful thing about that report is it's not just data. It's really experiential. It like really has, you know, it really goes into the actual like written experiences of what in the emotions of what people have gone through, because data shouldn't just be numbers. It was I would say it's definitely a big influence on the research study that we did when I went back to IDA with NAI. You know, that's what the purpose, again, we had that fund. But you know, we didn't want to start a fund on something in which we didn't actually know what people needed. The disabled community is one of those communities that there's hardly any research and data on this community specifically. They're often left out of you know, research around diversity and inclusion. It's starting to get better. It's starting to get better. But, you know, at the time, specifically around this fund, there just was no understanding of where people were. And so, you know, I gathered together a whole group of disabled-led, disabled-centered media organizations, as well as disabled practitioners. And we sort of brought everybody together to create this survey, to create this data, and to ask questions that needed to be asked, but just hadn't been asked of this community yet. It was super long. It was way too long, I'll admit. But we asked a lot of open-ended questions, you know, and, you know, took the time on our end to collate and to process all that data. And it did take us longer because of that. But, oh, it was so worth it. It was so worth it. And then we released a report around that data. You know, and then when we started to see the results of that survey, it was, you know, the majority, like over, I think it was like 60% that took it were folks that had been in the industry for more than 10 years. So these weren't new filmmakers who didn't know the field. These are people that, you know, have been doing this for a while. And 80% are self-funding their projects. That's huge. I mean, you know, I recognize the independence that self-funding can give you, but it also alienates you from the system. It takes you out of the system. And unfortunately, you know, the doc world is a system. And to like get your project elevated to be, you know, to be at the festivals where you're going to, you know, acquire distribution or get your project in front of the right people takes inserting yourself into that system. And so it was just clear that like, and, you know, of course, we got an avalanche of responses around, you know, festivals, programs, funds, all these things are not designed for us. They aren't thinking right. about us. People that review this content, they're not disabled people. The reason why they're called 1 in 4, you know, just in the United States itself, is because 1 in 4 people identify as disabled. That's a huge population of people. It's huge. And so it's just, yeah, it's a population that's consistently ignored. There is so much there. There is so much there.
So I want to kind of get into the climate for folks with disabilities in the context of this very unfortunate current U.S. administration, because that thing, I refuse to call him a man, has said some heinous things about people with disabilities, and then these cuts with Medicaid and Medicare are coming down the pike in the next 2 to 4 years. So just within the context of this current administration, particularly considering kind of like where we were with the past administration, because obviously it wasn't like super great in regards to people with disabilities. Because one thing I learned was that when I was working at Odyssey Impact, I did helped to do an impact campaign for a film called Breaking Silence, which is about the experience of people who are deaf and hard of hearing in CODA who are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I learned within the context of the American with Disabilities Act is, even though that is a civil rights act, that is a civil rights act specifically for people with disabilities, it is not enforced as it should be. And then in some places, that is not even applicable. For example, if you're incarcerated and you have a disability, you're pretty much, you have no access to resource, because apparently the ADA unofficially does not apply in incarcerated places where it doesn't imply, even though we assume this has been the law of the land since the 90s, there's still like so many gaps. So can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, there's a real, you know, from the, just speaking from the U.S. perspective, you know, ADA is really important to us here, but it's kind of the floor. It's the bare minimum, right? And that is now being challenged, particularly in courts. I can't understand this new like suggestion that DEI is discriminatory to other, you know, it's that sort of same like thought process and thinking that if you provide support to one person, then it's not fair to others, whatever that means. It's not about fair is not the word we're looking for. It's equity. And so it's about equity. And so, yeah, what concerns me most is that, you know, this is a U.S. attitude. You know, often we hear that this work only happens in the sort of more colonial spaces like U.S., Canada, the U.K., but that's just not true, that it is happening everywhere. And so my concern is that, you know, of course, the attitudes of the U.S. will influence the attitudes of the world. So, yeah, we just got to keep fighting for to at least maintain the ATA as things move forward. But also at the same time, the disabled community has always been excluded. And so, the disabled community will continue to take care of itself, and folks will continue to invest in mutual care and support around each other. And so all is not lost because we still have each other. But there is a lot of concern in our community right now.
Yeah, I went to Costa Rica a few years back for vacation, and they have a whole political party for people with disabilities that has some power.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go to the Costa Rica political party website, Wikipedia page, it's all the parties, and it's a blue flag, and it has the symbols of people in a wheelchair and someone signing, and yeah. So there are, in other places, and actually Costa Rica is really well known, particularly for a lot of foreigners moving to Costa Rica. They're known for their health care.
I was invited last year to BAM Bogota, which takes place in Bogota, Colombia. You know, and their country has a mandate around disability and accessibility, and so they also, as a country, did a report on the disability community and what they need. And we presented together our findings, which was a really, really great opportunity. But you know, it's good. Like, there's a good and bad in that, right? Like, sometimes when it's a government mandate, it doesn't necessarily mean that disabled people are leading that initiative. But at the same time, it does require everyone to participate. So, you know, give and take. But I think, yeah, it's been, yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, that's good. That's good. That's great. Okay, so let's get into DMA, Disability Media Alliance. So tell us how that grew from your going back to the IDA.
Yeah. So, yeah, as I was saying, you know, I started this new department at IDEA called the Nonfiction Access Initiative. It was really around creating that fund. We did eventually, with the data, we're able to create a fund. It was called the Direct Access Fund. And essentially, it supported 21 projects to provide access support to their project for either their director or their producer, which is, you know, a very important fund and much needed support that doesn't happen. As you had mentioned earlier, many programs that support disabled makers aren't designed for disabled people, and a lot of times the disabled maker will have to provide their own access or something like that. And so we had this fund that we were very open-minded about what access looks like and what access can mean. You know, we supported people paying some folks rent. We paid for some alternative medicine treatments. You know, we paid for all kinds of interesting ideas because we just wanted people to understand that sometimes it takes a little bit more for a disabled maker to just do their work. It is part of their work. And so, so we did that fund. But, you know, it was just kind of a way to chip at things. It wasn't necessarily a larger solution. So, the Ford Foundation came to us and was like, okay, you're very good here at IDA at like creating communities. Come to us with a bigger idea. And so, you know, it was, as I said, you know, we were bringing together all these different constituents from the community. And for many, particularly the organizations, it was the first time that they got to talk to each other and about what's going on and like, how are they doing? And one thing that really came up and that was very distinct was it was clear that institutions were competing against each other for funding, which is it totally goes against the values of the disabled community, and that we embrace collaboration over competition. And so, you know, in those conversations, we were like, okay, well, how can we figure out a way to make fundraising and disbursement of money more equitable around, you know, within the disability community? But also data from that report that was clear, again, that most support systems are not designed with disabled people in mind. And it's truly the organizations that are already embedded in these communities, that already are, you know, doing the work, are the ones that need to be supported the most. And so that's sort of the beginnings of DMA. You know, we really wanted to focus on creating more funds, more mentorship opportunities, more development programs that are specifically for disabled and designed for disabled people that are being given and being administered and decisions were being made by disabled people themselves in order to better serve the community.
Awesome. So I just want you to kind of like talk about like what are some of the first projects that DMA is going to be working on?
Yeah. So we've just been spending the past year. We're like, you know, I mean, a lot of the work that we're doing is about building infrastructure, right? It's like putting disabled people in the positions of power and making decisions. And so, you know, and if we're going to promote that for others, we have to do that for ourselves. So this past year has been really about, you know, really building a strong infrastructure for ourselves and, you know, doing things like community agreements and like having, you know, a written document about how do we say that we work, what is our staff culture internally? How do we work with others? And that's a lot of those kinds of things, just like a lot of interior values establishing sort of work. But as far as like actual outward stuff that we're going to be doing, initially, the first thing we want to do is to create a mapping tool and just to really get a sense of where other organizations are and other institutions are that are doing this work to support disabled people all over the world. We have a good sense domestically of who's doing this work, but we know that there are other regions of the world, other countries that are doing this work, and we want to know what it is. And so, yeah, so that's really our first step is to see where people are and then to really map that work for filmmakers. So they have a sense of like, what's out there for me? What can support me?
Right.
We're also, you know, there isn't support in your region and you're like, hey, I'm a disability filmmaker in this part of the world. I'd love to see more support for me. What do you know? Right. Who, what can we do? You know, this is something that we kind of did with our founding organizations. You know, I call them our founding organizations, which are AXS, Film Fund, QuocMap, the Forward Doc, of course, and then the Documentary Association of Pakistan, and then One in Four Coalition. Yeah. These are all co-founding organizations. But with the Disability Association of Pakistan, that the executive director at that organization is somebody who identified with having a disability. And they joined the conversation being like, you know, I know there's a big community of folks here in Pakistan, but we haven't identified them yet. So we would like to do that work. And so I worked with them to just like, let's see how we can do outreach. Let's see how we can get to them to help develop a community there. And then those folks participated in the NAI survey. They did, you know, we collected data on them and then we gave that data back to them so they could utilize that for their institution, for their organization to help develop programs, help with funding, you know, whatever it is to help progress that organization. And so that's also part of this, what we want to continue to do, you know. And so, yeah, so it was And also through that mapping, we'll start, you know, we want to start like just asking the organizations, what's going on? How are you doing? How are you surviving? Like, what kind of programs can we create to help you reinforce your institution, your nonprofit, so that you stay soluble? Also, how can we work together on certain issues in the disability community? You know, the challenges and the barriers for disabled makers is not a monolith. It's not just a single, oh, here, just, you know, we'll give money to disability and that'll take care of it. There's a lot of different myriad of issues that need supported, you know, and so it's also changing the idea in people's brains about like what are all the different complex aspects of disability support that are needed. It's not just getting people to film festivals. It's not just captioning. There are a lot of other issues that need to be addressed. And so, yeah, we are also, you know, trying to fundraise just for an emergency fund for these organizations. Particularly as the rhetoric of ideas about who disabled people are, particularly disabled professionals, you know, is being spewed. It is making it more challenging for these institutions to get supported, to find funding. And so, yeah, it's an interesting time to be starting a nonprofit. But I think it's because of the kinds of work we're trying to do, it feels absolutely necessary that we unify these organizations in this way at this time, because we're stronger together.
So if an organization, someone from an organization hears this podcast and they work with people with disabilities in their country and they want to be part of your mapping process, like how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, well, you can get in touch with us through our website. It's disabilitymedia.org. There's a form on there. You can reach out to me directly. I'm also not afraid to give out my email address, which is it's Rennell@disabilitymedia.org. So I love engaging with people. I love a out of nowhere email. So if there are folks that want to engage in this work, oh, please reach out because I want to know about you.
And do people contribute to Disability Media Alliance?
Oh, they can fund. They can give us some support. That's for sure. yeah, I think that, you know, that's what we're looking. If you are outside and you're looking to support the community, because you're not just supporting us, you're not just supporting DMA, you're supporting a whole infrastructure, a whole community of organizations with your support.
So what are some things that folks who don't have disabilities, who are, I don't like to use the word allies, I like to use co-conspirators. What are some of the things that co-conspirators can do? And let me distinguish, a co-conspirator is actually someone who's actually willing to put their body or metaphoric body online for a particular cause, versus an ally, someone says, oh, I'm for something, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're actually doing anything. So we want more co-conspirators. So what can someone who is a person who doesn't have a disability, but who wants to get engaged in this work, what they can they do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's especially really encourage this of industry people, if there are industry people listening or even filmmakers, when you're participating on panels, when you're having a screening, when, you know, whatever it may be, like ask for things to be captioned, ask for ASL support, even if you don't need it, because there's going to be somebody else who does. And you have a lot of power being part of something. And so utilize that power and that opportunity to ask for support for others. So I really, really, really encourage that. I also really encourage you to really, for those of you who, a lot of times folks, you know, don't really think about disability until it affects them personally, whether that's because it's something that you, it's a, you know, something your own experience or someone in your family. But I really encourage people to really think about their own personal attitudes and ideas about disability. We really want to try to eliminate is this idea of pity or treating disabled people as inspiration. And you know, really, I really encourage folks to fund disabled makers to tell these stories. The world of documentary has really benefited from stories of disability since its iteration. And we really should be, you know, and again, it's created this dynamic of, you know, many films are about, you know, that put people as something to feel sorry for rather than, you know, it's who we are. It's just who makes us who we are. And so I really encourage you to fund disabled makers, listen to disabled makers, put them in the position of being to tell the stories themselves. But yeah, those are just a few things that folks can do. But really, I really encourage you to investigate your own feelings around disability and why you may think that, because you'll really discover a lot about yourself.
I also want to add making film sets accessible. I can't remember the name of it, but some organization, I think the Hollywood Reporter did an article about it, but they created essentially this chart that you could use to actually make your budget accessible. So they had these different ranges. So if your film budget was under $500,000, you could pad it by an extra 3 or 5% to make it accessible. And that means in regards to hiring crew with disabilities and making sure you're accommodations for those folks, so you can put that in your budget. But also being thinking about shooting schedules, because someone with a disability, it can be very difficult to do a standard 12-hour shooting day. I mean, that can be difficult to anybody. So maybe incorporate longer shooting times, particularly if you're having crew with disabilities. These are little things you can begin to do to even make their film sets more accessible, to increase that hiring, to open up the hiring pool for people.
And, you know, when you start investigating these things, you may actually see that they benefit folks that aren't necessarily disabled, but have that are creating situations in which, you know, for mothers or, you know, folks that who also have, you know, similar barriers to entry around things, you're also supporting them. I also want to mention, as you were mentioning budgets, the new IDA budget template now includes costs around access and accessibility. So I really encourage you to take a look at that as well. I hope we get to a place where funders see that as a requirement, and that you know, that your project doesn't get funded unless you have lines around accessibility and accessibility support in your projects as well.
All right. Well, we're getting the signal that we need to wrap up. So always like to give the guests the last word. So any final thoughts, Renell?
Yeah, I think one thing that, you know, I'd like us to all of us in the industry, whether we're filmmakers or, you know, industry people, to really start to consider is let's stop valuing people's ability to endure.
Come on.
And, you know, it's just, I know that I've compromised myself for a long time and was celebrated for it. Mm-hmm. That was detrimental to me. And, you know, this is not a new idea. I hear this, you know, again, my friend Jim Brack says this all the time, but when we do that, we lose so much brilliance, and so many folks that could have brought something wonderful and could have contributed didn't, just because of this idea that we were, in order for greatness, we have to suffer. And it's just not true. It's just not true. And so, yeah, if anything, that's just a thought I'd like to leave folks with.
Okay, that's some preaching. That is, yeah, it says No need to suffer, and martyrdom is overrated.
Yep.
And it's not scary.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just not worth it.
All right, Winnell. Well, this is amazing. So glad to have this opportunity to chat with you like this. And Renelle and I are actually going to be continuing this conversation because I teach at Saybrook University, and Renelle is going to be on a panel for the new students coming in, along with Caitlin Yang, who she mentioned. And we're going to be talking about crip time and disability in the artistic space. Unfortunately, that's going to be open to Saybrook students, but there may be a recording available, so we will let y'all know if that is the case. But Renelle, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. And I want to thank Anne and Nadia again for, I guess it's year 5 or 6 on collaborating with Doc Leipzig. And thank you everybody for listening.
Yeah. Thank you, Tony. Yeah. Thanks for being such a huge influence in my life, Tony. Thank you.
Back at you, girl.